This is a Federal News Network podcast.
The oldest information system the government operates might also be the most crucial one. No, not the IRS master file system. It's the technology that controls nuclear weapons. It dates to the 1950s. Yet imagine if the control systems were online in the age of ransomware. My next guest has thought about exactly that. A longtime scholar and researcher in cybersecurity, he's written a book called Cyber Threats and Nuclear Weapons. Stanford University fellow Herb Lin joins me now. Dr. Lin, good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
And your book deals really with two parts of the surrounding control of the nuclear enterprise. One is the very ancient systems that have launch control and communications among the silos. And then there are the larger DoD communication systems that overlay that. And those are the ones at this point that are vulnerable in a cyber sense. But tell us what's going on with those lower level systems that were installed when the silos were built.
What you're talking about is the fact that a lot of the command and control systems and the stuff that's responsible for actually launching the weapons and so on do date back a long way. No missile silos of the sort that you're talking about in the 1950s, but certainly in the 1960s. That's absolutely true. And there's computer technology that is actually pretty ancient. So the concern there is how you maintain old technology, even though it's working properly, you know, the manufacturers go out of business and so on. And now you have to buy parts at eBay or something like that. On the other hand, the old system, precisely because it's so old, tends to be a lot more resistant to today's cyber threats. For example, they're not connected to the internet directly. That's one thing. Another thing, of course, is that a software hack that you wrote for something, for some modern machine and so on, just wouldn't run on one of these machines. So from a cybersecurity standpoint, the old system is a whole lot more secure.
And there is a gambit to this. Programs have been going on for some years, and Congress funds them, and they don't fund them. They go back and forth, depending on the administration, to upgrade and modernize a lot of that. Not the warheads themselves, but everything leading up to the warheads. So is the danger that if they modernize those systems, they would just default toward an internet-based communications system, and then the nuclear weapons are right there along with some database of names and numbers?
I would say that that's an overly simplified way of looking at it. But I think that the general point that you're making, I think, is at least one that people have to take into account, which is that whatever you upgrade in from an old system to basically a completely new system, what you're doing is you're introducing the possibility of new problems coming in because you have a new system. And a new system, by definition, hasn't been around for a very long time. And the way you shake out bugs and problems in a system is you let it operate for a long time, and then you find the bugs in operation and so on. And, you know, this funny glitch here is then you investigate it and then you fix it and so on. By definition, a new system hasn't had a wealth of experience behind it, of operational experience behind it. And every computer person knows that those are the circumstances under which you reveal bugs, problems. So as you bring new stuff online, there's always a risk of increasing the possibility of more bugs and more problems in the system. That doesn't mean, by the way, that you should not upgrade. It just means that when you upgrade, you got to do this very, very carefully. And in my book, I talk about some of the ways of making sure that you get it right.
We're speaking with Dr. Herb Lin. He is senior research scholar at the Center for International Security and Cooperation and a fellow at Stanford University. And what about the other parts of the nuclear enterprise that are connected to the internet because they're connected to other DoD systems, command and control systems, communications to the White House, I guess, or to that so-called football they carry? What about the cyber threats there? You've written about that also.
Well, one of the things about the Department of Defense is that their technology, in fact, while it's most of the Department of Defense is, in fact, more modern than the stuff that's used on the nuclear side of the house, it probably isn't as modern as what's on your desk. And so it's like instead of being 1960s and 70s technology, it's 1980s and 90s technology or something like that, not 2019. And so there's that problem. So when you say, are there vulnerabilities in the rest of the Department of Defense command and control system? Of course, there are vulnerabilities in it. Dealing with those vulnerabilities was one of the rationales for why they stood up U.S. Cyber Command to help defend against them. That was back in, I guess, in 2010 or 2009, something like that. So that the department is very well aware of the cyber vulnerabilities in the rest of the networks and tries its best to fix them. But even DoD would not say there are no vulnerabilities in it.
And why have so far nothing disastrous happened, do you think, say, from North Korea, for example, which seems to have pretty good cybersecurity hacking chops from what we can tell? Is it that they are just waiting for the right moment to do what they're capable of doing, or they haven't quite figured everything out yet?
Part of the problem is that it's not all that easy to hack into the DoD. The DoD is not bad. On the other hand, I think nobody who looks at this rests easy when it looks at the capabilities of adversaries, and especially during a war, right? You don't deploy in peacetime or even in times of tension, you don't deploy the capabilities that you would be using during wartime. So there's no reason in particular to think that we've seen the worst that North Korea or China or Russia or anybody else could throw at us.
And discuss the possibility of the wartime being a cyber event. And you also have some expertise in the offensive cyber operations that we know the Defense Department has, but they've been very reluctant, first of all, to talk about them that much, let alone to deploy them, as far as we can tell. And so should there be a little bit more active use of cyber preventive measures, which might look like cyber aggression coming from our side, to prevent what could happen from the other side?
Let me rephrase what I think you just said. I think you asked the question, should we be penetrating them and hassling them in cyberspace a little bit more in order to prevent their hassling us in the future? I think that's what you asked.
Yes, that's why you're the professor.
Okay, right. And so the answer is that, in fact, in 2018, U.S. Cyber Command did, in fact, announce exactly such a doctrine. It's what they call defend forward and persistent engagement. It's all oriented towards defense in the sense that we're trying to protect ourselves. And the theory behind this is that persistently engaging the adversary is going to force them to spend more of their efforts on defense rather than on offense. The argument is they have a limited amount of resources. There's a certain balance of offense and defense that they use right now, and that if we hassle them some more, they'll be forced to shift resources from offense into defense, thereby being able to harm us less. So the DoD has actually set this out quite straightforwardly in a doctrinal statement that's on the web.
All right. And getting to your book, Cyber Threats and Nuclear Weapons, what's the main message you're trying to get across here?
The main message that I'm trying to get across in the book, cyber threats affect all of the nuclear enterprise, sort of from soup to nuts. Most people who have looked at the cyber threat to nuclear weapons have focused on the command and control system, and they should have. That has been a good thing. The lesson that I want to underscore is that cyber affects every aspect of the problem of the nuclear enterprise, not just the command and control. So there are potential possible issues with nuclear warhead reliability and the like. I'm less concerned about that, actually. But there are a lot of problems potentially with nuclear weapons delivery systems. And there's a lot of problems even within the command and control. People worry about the idea that somebody might penetrate the system and issue a false launch order or something like that. I'm not actually particularly worried about that. But there are all sorts of sensitive databases and so on that need to be protected. And I mean, it's very complicated to run a nuclear delivery system. I mean, a whole architecture of, you know, weapon systems and command and control and so on that will actually result in nuclear weapons being delivered where they're supposed to be delivered.
And also there's the issue of the many simulations that they do head by head, so to speak, because they can't test them anymore. Those
right.
tests are done on networks of supercomputers and done by the way
right.
scientific.
That's right. That's right. And they're not connected to the internet, but you know, you have to worry about the integrity of the data that they rely on and so on. And as I say, I'm not all that worried about the Department of Energy. On the other hand, there are potential threats that they have to be aware of.
Anything else you think they really need to know?
Yeah, there is one other major point that I didn't get to here, which is that one of the big deals that the new administration and the past administration, too, has been pushing is this idea of conventional nuclear integration. That is a greater integration between the U.S. conventional forces and nuclear forces. And they have a variety of doctrinal reasons for wanting and strategic reasons for wanting to do this. But whatever comes out of that, they would be calling for greater integration of nuclear and conventional forces. And that means a command and control system that is set up to do that will have to support conventional nuclear integration. Now, it seems to me that you have to believe that a command and control system that is set up to do both conventional and nuclear integration is going to be more complex than a system just designed to support nuclear operations. I mean, it seems to me that you take that as a premise. And all of the history, all computer systems development suggests that when you make a system more complex, you make it more cyber vulnerable. That is, complexity is the enemy of security. Every computer professional will acknowledge that. So I worry a lot that as we start to demand more and more out of our nuclear command and control systems, like, for example, trying to integrate into a conventional command and control network as well, that we're actually insisting on systems whose security is going to be much more difficult to ensure. And I really worry about that. It's not clear to me that the benefits are worth the risk. That's a strategic decision that has to be made, but somebody needs to be worrying about that trade-off. You can't just say that, oh, we're going to integrate it, we're going to do this integration, and we'll make it secure. I mean, you can't just say that because there are trade-offs there.
Dr. Herb Lin is Senior Research Scholar at the Center for International Security and Cooperation, a fellow at Stanford University, and author of Cyber Threats and Nuclear Weapons, published by Stanford. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll post this interview along with a link to more information at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I am your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Vice Admiral Cutler Dawson. Cutler has had an incredible career serving our country for 35 years in the Navy, where he attained the rank of Vice Admiral. And during his service, he had numerous assignments afloat and ashore, including Commander, Second Fleet, Striking Fleet Atlantic, and in Washington at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, where he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Immediately following his retirement from active duty in 2004, he became the president and CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, the world's largest credit union, where he served for 14 years. Under his leadership, Navy Federal grew from 2 million to 8 million members. Phenomenal. Cutler, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've had a fascinating career across both military and the private sector. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your professional journey?
Well, I started out at the Naval Academy, where I graduated in 1970, and then, as you mentioned, spent 35 years in the Navy with six actual afloat commands. The first one was when I was 27 years old. I didn't know enough to be scared of anything, and it was probably one of the highlights of my career. And then after I retired after 35 years, I went to work at Navy Federal Credit Union as the CEO, where I spent my next 14 years. I'm currently retired and enjoying life, and it's been a great run for me.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over the years?
My style has been quite consistent. I believe, and I learned this in the Navy, that you have to go to the deck plates to see what is going on. And you have to learn what your people do and how they do it so you can help them to be better at it and more efficient and more productive. It's something that you need to do all the time. I remember I used to tell folks that you don't want to retreat to your cabin. And what I mean by that is the longer you're in a position, the less you think you have to get out and about. But that should be the opposite. You should get out and about more, because people change, situations change, and you've got to figure out a way to get to them and find out what they're doing and what you can do to help them.
We'll talk a little bit more about your book, but I read it, From Sea to the C-Suite. Fantastic read. You talk about the deck plates in that as well. I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this and read some more detail about going to the deck plates. Cutler, who was the most impactful leader in your life, and what quality did you admire about them?
I had numerous while I was in the Navy, but the quality that I enjoyed the most was the leaders that got to know me as an individual, and that they cared about me, and I could tell that they cared about me. And they were not only my leaders, but they were my mentors. And I remember one particular one, Bill Schiffer, when I had my first assignment at the Pentagon. I would go in to see him with my problem of the day, and I knew that he had numerous problems of his own, but he would stop, and he would focus on me, and he would make me feel like I was the most important person in his world. And I tried to do that throughout my career. But really, it's about caring for your people.
Cutler, in reading your book, there was a quote you used that you use to inspire those people that work for you. And it really got my attention. And it was you are the captain of your own ship. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that means and how it was useful to you and the leaders you were developing.
Absolutely. What I mean by captain of your own ship, when you are the captain of a ship, sometimes you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't have anybody to turn to make decisions. You don't have anybody to turn to ask, what should I do now? You have to be the captain of that ship. And I translated that into, let's say, Navy Federal's organization, where I would tell branch managers that I said, you are the captain of the ships of Navy Federal. You're the ones that are facing the members or customers, as others call them, every day. And you have to make decisions without a lot of guidance in some cases and without a lot of time. So be the captain of your own ship. Step up, make decisions, do what you think is right, and you never can go wrong.
I think that is so important. And you have to give your people a little bit of latitude to take some risk as well, because there is risk for them in doing that and risk to your organization.
That's right. And I mentioned that I took command of my first ship with 5 years in the Navy, and I was 27 years old. Well, my boss had 32 years in the Navy, and his guidance to me when I first met him was, Cutler, you do the right thing, and I'll back you up all the way. What a wonderful way to spend an assignment with backup and guidance like that.
What great advice. It's clear leadership is a topic you're passionate about. You wrote the book we mentioned before, From Sea to C-Suite. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes. When I was at Navy Federal, I would tell sea stories as parables to get my point across. And folks would tell me, Cutler, we like your stories. It gives us a picture of what you're trying to tell us. Now, what else are they going to say? They work for me, but I took it as a compliment, and it was. And my wife encouraged me to write a book, and I needed a co-author to help me. And I found a lady named Taylor Keelan, who was the perfect co-author. She turned in my stories into wonderful chapters that I'm very proud of.
Where can listeners find a copy?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it on the Naval Institute website. And I might add that any proceeds from the book, Navy Federal uses to give to charity.
Fantastic. Cutler, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your time and your lessons and in leadership and sharing with us your life story. And I've learned a lot both from talking to you today and reading your book. And thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. And I would like to add one thing if I could, Shane. During my assignments in Washington, D.C., I gain the utmost respect for the civilians that work here every day. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, and they have my eternal gratitude. I got to come and go from the Pentagon. They stayed every day and worked in Washington when I got to go out and enjoy being at sea.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, WAPO serves civilian federal employees, but your comment is well taken because the interaction between the two is continuous, it's nonstop, and it's critical. So the career civil servants, as well as career military, our country would not be where it is today without them.
I totally agree. And I can tell you from the U.S. Navy standpoint, we couldn't operate like we do without them being the backbone of what we do.
Thank you very much for your time today, Cutler, and to everyone listening to Lessons in Leadership podcast. We'll see you next time.